Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by High-Tech Answers and Healthcare Now Radio, part of the Answers Media Network, and is sponsored by the Law Offices of Myrick O'Connell. Now here is your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Troy Young, VP of Engineering and the Security Officer at AdvancedMD. Welcome, Troy. So what I always like to do before I really get into the main part of the discussion is allow my guests to give a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who you are and what you do.
Well, great. Thanks. Yeah. So again, my name is Troy Young, and I've been a engineering leader at AdvancedMD for about 19 years. And then for the past 4 years, I've been leading the security team as well. And basically just developed a sort of a passion for security, having been involved in implementing HIPAA security and privacy rules here within AdvancedMD. And ultimately went to pursue my master's degree in cybersecurity and just graduated a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, enjoying being in the security role.
Oh, well, first off, congratulations. And
thanks.
I think you might be the first person that I've talked to who says they have a master's in cybersecurity. So what does that degree entail?
Yeah, it's actually not a very common degree, to be honest with you. In fact, I graduated from Utah Valley University and was in their first cohort of graduates. The program barely got accredited about 3 years ago as I was starting into it. But it covers a lot of different topics, goes into some of the obvious stuff you would think of, web application security, network security, things like that. But we also got to dive into some other areas that I'm really interested in, like compliance. We actually talked a fair amount about HIPAA, and in spite of the fact it wasn't really a healthcare-oriented program, HIPAA is obviously a hot topic. And so we spent some time on that. And in fact, I did a term paper on that we might talk a little bit about today.
Sure. Well, why not just take the opportunity you gave us in that introduction and, to do a very deep dive into HIPAA is obviously very appealing to me since I often spend lots of parts of my day advising clients on some of the nuances. So I'd be very interested to hear kind of what you focused on for your paper.
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to. Basically, what I looked at was the resolution agreements that the OCR has completed over the past, 12 years or so. And what I was primarily focusing on was what are those things that most frequently trigger an audit by the OCR in the first place? And then once the audit has been triggered, what are the things that result in the largest fines or that are most frequently cited in the resolution agreement? And came out with some, I think, fairly interesting findings. A lot of them wouldn't necessarily be groundbreaking. One thing that I wasn't aware of is just the sheer volume of complaints that the OCR handles. I think over the course of a dozen years or so, they did like 160,000 or something, handled 160,000 complaints. And out of all those, there were only 55 penalties that came out of it, either resolution agreements or financial penalties. So really the likelihood of getting, what we refer to as a HIPAA fine is relatively low, but you still have to be very concerned about being targeted for an audit just because the process itself is so expensive. You know, even though there was only 55 entities, covered entities that arrived at a penalty or a resolution agreement, there were tens of thousands that had to go through the process, which of course, it's very cumbersome and time intensive.
No, that's a very good point. It's and I, kind of as you're saying, I often tell people it's the very rare occurrence, frankly, where a fine or a penalty is imposed. But the amount of stress and concern that you go through whenever you have any type of audit or investigation conducted by OCR is potentially even more burdensome than having to actually make a monetary payment.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
So kind of turning back to, as you said, you were looking to see, whether there are trends or commonalities across, what were some of the specific findings that you developed?
Yeah, so there were about a half a dozen, maybe eight different things that I saw a lot of. One of the biggest ones, obviously, is kind of a broad category of just not having adequate security safeguards in place. And so this is things like you don't have a firewall on your network or you don't have your hard drives encrypted on your laptops or your desktop computers, that kind of thing. Another big one, probably the second biggest one, is just not having appropriate policies and procedures in place. It's a very common thing. I think a lot of people kind of ignore having the stuff on paper that they need to prove that they're doing the things they're supposed to be doing. A lot of times, practices or vendors or whoever, they may be doing really well in terms of protecting patient data, but they may not be able to prove it. They don't have documentation to describe what they're doing. Another big one is not having risk analysis done. That's something that HIPAA requires that we do every year. And it's cumbersome and it's kind of painful, but it's a requirement, especially the first time you do it, it can be difficult, but it's a requirement that we do that. And then not responding appropriately to the assessment. When you find vulnerabilities and you don't respond to them, not having BAAs with your business associates is a big deal for the OCR. So those are some of the big ones that I found really tended to result in the biggest fines and most frequently be cited.
I don't know if this was part of it, but or maybe just from your general experience, but do you have any kind of hypotheses as to why those seem to be such common pain points, especially, I think, I don't know if you directly said it, but, kind of implying, those are some fairly basic elements of HIPAA and basic mm-hmm. elements of demonstrating compliance with HIPAA.
They are. As I mentioned, I've worked for AdvancedMD for 19 years, and our sweet spot sort of for most of that time has been small practice, independent practices, usually with 1 to 5 physicians, up to 20. These are practices, these are businesses that don't necessarily have dedicated IT resources. They certainly don't have dedicated security resources. And so I think that it's just a natural tendency to focus on their main thing, which is focusing on patient healthcare. So I think that's a big part of it. And just sort of a thought that, we're so small, OCR won't possibly come after us, but that's obviously not a safe route to take. The OCR has indicated that they will go after, smaller practices when it's appropriate. So really everyone needs to be taking these steps. But I think that's really what it comes down to, honestly, is, doctors went to school to be doctors. Nurses went to school to be nurses. They didn't go to school to be security officers.
No, I definitely agree that it is challenging, especially when, as you just said, focusing on some of these activities is beyond the scope of what the individual actually wants to do. And it's even when that recognition is provided, it still feels like it's an uphill battle to convince people to even just allow an outside party to provide the assistance and mm-hmm. Help advance the ball.
Yeah, that's very true. One thing that I've advised some of our customers to do is to look up the guidance that's been provided by the OCR in the form of a HIPAA. A book of basically a pamphlet or book, I call it a book of HIPAA guidelines that are pretty straightforward. It's actually the title of it. It's put out by the ONC, actually. It's called The Guide to Privacy and Security of Electronic Health Information. I'm sure you've read it, come across that. They've done a really nice job, honestly, in terms of explaining in detail the things that even a small practice should do, having a security officer, having a privacy officer, those kinds of things. And it's broken down into chapters. And, so one suggestion I've given in the past is, even for a small practice, you don't have to boil the ocean. Maybe what you could do is take that guide and once a month get together with some of your key players within your practice and read a chapter and walk away with some action points for that chapter. And don't worry about the rest of it for that month, but for that month, just kind of think about what you can do on that chapter and then kind of rotate that. And you can just, I think there's something like 9 chapters or something. You can cover it pretty well within a year, which, seems like a long time to address some of these things. But, in a practice that's been more or less ignoring HIPAA for 15 years, 9 months is not bad. So, and I think it's a realistic thing to do. So that's one piece of advice that I've given in the past.
Yeah, and arguably kind of having those monthly meetings helps to create a reinforcing culture of compliance and a culture of awareness of the requirements.
Right. Absolutely. And it's a simple thing you can do. Anybody can do it. I mean, even in a busy practice, surely you can dedicate an hour, right, out of a month. So you can't do everything, but you can certainly do something.
Yes. No, and I'd kind of like to turn back to one of the comments you made and kind of use that to go off in a different direction. And the comment was that, saying that some of these small practices may feel like they're too small to to garner the attention of OCR, or, you know, this is kind of a rough transition, is, you know, the, you know, arguably garner the attention of attackers. So would like to get your assessment in terms of, you know, is there really any entity out there that is too small to actually face and potentially suffer an outside attack or an inside attack?
It's a great question. You know, bear in mind that, you know, a lot of times when we think about hacking, you know, we think about Matthew Broderick in his basement, you know, attacking whatever, and guessing passwords, this kind of stuff. That's really not what we see happen most often these days. Hackers today, they just want money, and they want easy money. They don't want hard money. They want easy money. And so, you know, ransomware is obviously a huge topic in healthcare today, because, you know, what other industry is more willing to pay, you know, $1,000, $10,000, whatever, to get their data back if it's basically stolen by ransomware? You know, even a bank, you know, hopefully the banks have the security in place, although you'd be surprised, you know, but who else, if you've got a patient that's going to suffer health consequences or even, you know, risk death because you don't have their data, you're going to cough up $10,000, you know, in a heartbeat. So, you know, these attackers know that it's easy money. So, in particular, you know, ransomware attacks, you know, much more so than what it used to be. You know, it used to be that, hey, you could get, you know, $200 for a healthcare record as opposed to $6 for a credit card number. And so it used to be, yeah, let's go after the data and sell it online. Well, you know, that's been done so much, it's not really that big of a deal anymore. But ransomware, you know, it's so easy to distribute it. They've got kits, right? You can go online and you can download a kit that'll generate ransomware for you and distribute it, you know, distribute the emails to get it pushed out to practices. It's just so easy. Hackers want easy money. And so, you know, even a very small practice with only a few patients absolutely can be the target of a ransomware attack.
From that perspective, are you seeing that more practices than maybe are being reported are actually paying the ransom then?
Well, you know, I don't have any hard data on that. All I have is anecdotal evidence just from articles that I read. But I, you know, yeah, the perception that I have right now is that the knee-jerk response is to pay the ransom.
That's very interesting. So, you know, I think that one is directly contrary, obviously, to the advice that the FBI has provided, which is never
absolutely
paid. You know, kind of as you said, this information is the lifeblood for these practices. It would then also suggest that these practices are, to the extent that they're not even thinking seriously enough about security, also aren't thinking enough about redundancy or backups that would allow for recovery without having to pay a ransom.
Yeah. So, you know, another piece of advice that I give, and I'm biased. I work for a cloud software company, but really anything that you can put in the cloud where there's some level of sort of automatic redundancy, even in things as simple as email. You know, we've gotten to the point now where even small practices probably shouldn't have their own email server. They should probably be using Gmail accounts or Office 365. You know, there's a number of different options for keeping their email in the cloud, which keeps it, you know, safer than if it's on-prem. A lot of practices are using EHRs and PMs that are in the cloud, you know, which isn't absolutely necessary. If you have the appropriate resources, obviously you can protect software that you host within your practice. It's just, you know, it's just so much easier if you put it out in the cloud, and, you know, as long as you vet your vendor appropriately and make sure they have the protections in place. But, you know, even with all of that, there are still going to be things you're going to store within your practice. You should probably minimize the amount that you store internally, but there's always going to be something. So, you know, making sure that you have two-factor authentication in place and making sure that you have backups of that data, all those traditional measures that you should always have been taking are still relevant today.
And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Troy Young from AdvancedMD, and we've been talking about HIPAA background and compliance and now getting some deeper into security. And, you know, Troy, kind of what you were just talking about, of really, it sounds like the creation of a hybrid approach when it comes to file and data storage by practices. You're talking about, and I definitely agree with you, that cloud has an important and major role to play. What are some of the kind of diligence questions that you'd suggest people pursue when they're vetting a potential cloud vendor?
That's a great question. And and always been kind of a difficult thing in the past. There are a couple of advantages I think that we have today that we maybe didn't have, you know, as recently as 5 or 10 years ago. You know, one is, while we could certainly be cynical about a lot of things related to government regulation like HIPAA and meaningful use, maps, those kind of things, the fact that we're now required to have business associate agreements in place, and that those business associate agreements tend to have, you know, the boilerplate agreements that you'll find tend to have some pretty good questions in them, pretty good requirements. You know, if you make sure, you know, in your discussions with vendors that they are meeting all the requirements in a typical boilerplate BAA, you're probably in pretty good shape. The other thing is, and I'm not promoting HITRUST. It's a nonprofit that I don't have any relationship to, but, you know, HITRUST is a new, relatively new security framework and certification program that's sponsored by, it's a consortium of a bunch of different companies. And but what they've done is basically combined HIPAA with some industry standard security platform frameworks like ISO 27001, kind of put it together. And they've taken HIPAA, which is very vague, and made it much more prescriptive so that we know exactly what's going on. So one trend is that HITRUST is becoming more and more accepted among hospitals and health systems and vendors and so forth. And so, you know, if you can go to your vendor and say, hey, are you HITRUST certified, which means that you have an audited HITRUST report, or do you have at least a self-assessment against HITRUST that we can look at? That can answer a lot of the questions they have in place. But back to your question more at a basic level, obviously making sure they have a good backup routine, making sure that they have a good, they have good network security, making sure that they encrypt their data at rest, and just overall having a conversation perhaps with their security officer at a high level of what are the measures that you've put in place to ensure that my data is going to be safe with you. You know, and they can have a conversation about what kind of measures are there.
Yes. No, and I guess thinking if people or practices do that up front, are enough people continuing to ask the questions throughout the life of a relationship as well?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, the good news is that, you know, most vendors are getting new customers. And so those new customers are continuing to ask questions. And so that keeps us honest. But no, it's a good point that, you know, on a regular basis, you really should be reviewing security with your vendors on an annual basis. You know, if nothing else, on an annual basis, saying, hey, could you just share with us at a high level any improvements you've made to your security controls in the last year? Is there anything that we should know about? Like I said, though, for the most part, if you have an active vendor that's growing and that's acquiring new customers, those difficult questions are being asked almost every day. I deal with them basically constantly. I'm continuously responding to requests from our new customers, and every once in a while they'll kind of get me, right? There'll be something that we go, oh, well, you know what? Gee, we're 95% there, but yeah, we have a little bit of work to do there. So, but yeah, so those are continuously coming in.
Yeah, and that continuous ability to consider and pay attention to the issues, I think, is a good one. It's kind of, as you're saying, the spur for it isn't necessarily important so much as the exercise of actually going through it and then performing that honest self-assessment.
Right, absolutely.
So kind of maybe going back a few steps, you know, in the fact you were talking about that there are so many attacks that are focused on healthcare, I think. And, you know, part of it, as you said, is that the attackers just want the easy money. So, you know, sending out a large volume of attacks and then only getting a few hits is arguably more efficient than trying to go after particular targets. There is a perception that healthcare is more frequently targeted or maybe more vulnerable than other industries. So are either or both of those accurate perceptions or representations?
Yeah, they really are. I'm trying to remember specifically. I had some numbers in my head specifically around ransomware attacks. So, you know, one particular stat that I can point at, and this is, you know, a couple of years old, but things haven't changed that much, is that there's one particular type of ransomware called CryptoWall. And at this point in time, a couple of years ago, healthcare providers were 4.5 times as likely to be hit by CryptoWall as any other group of people. So yeah, it's more than just a perception. It's it really is true for, you know, all the reasons that we talked about. You know, if you have an easy target that you can get money from, why not? Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, as you said, most people will chase the dollar signs, and in that chase will also most likely go to the place where the most money can be obtained for the least mm-hmm. amount of effort.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, there's a picture that I use sometimes when I do training or conference presentations. You've probably seen there's a picture. It's a great picture of a bear chasing a couple of photographers. And then, you know, there's the joke that I'm sure you've heard about the two hikers. And they're walking down the trail. All of a sudden, they see a bear, and the bear comes after them. And so one of them kneels down and pulls his running shoes out of his backpack, starts to put them on. The other guy says, hey, you can't outrun a bear just because you put tennis shoes on. And the other guy says, well, I don't have to outrun the bear. I only have to outrun you. And that's kind of true with security as well, where because they're looking for easy money, and this may sound a little bit cruel, but you know, if I have better security measures in place than the practice next door, they're going to go after them. They're not going to come after me. So that's why I said, you know, before, you don't have to do everything, but do something. So if you're, you know, if you're taking even the most basic measures, you're in a better position than a practice that isn't taking those basic measures.
No, and that, I think that is a very good point as well. And it's when you're thinking about the measures to implement, are there, and also back to the point that you made that HIPAA by itself is pretty vague, and I think mm-hmm. purposefully so, because that way it's become flexible and scalable.
Right.
Are there particular security measures that a practice should focus on first?
Yeah, there's a number of things. You know, the human factor is huge. If for example, you don't have training in place to help your employees recognize a phishing attack, that's got to be the first place to start. Generally, the most common source of ransomware is going to be an email attack. And by the same token, the most common way that a bad guy is going to get your credentials and get access to your email and that kind of thing is going to be through an email attack. And so if your staff is trained and they can very quickly recognize what a phishing attack looks like, and they know what to do when one comes in, if they know who to report it to, or how to respond when they see something, even if it's just as simple as just deleting it, that's one of the most important things you can do. Another thing that, you know, just keeps up coming up year after year after year is lost devices with unencrypted data on it. So, you know, clearly, you know, encrypting your laptops, encrypting your phone, encrypting your desktop machines, basically any device that you have PHI on, it's got to be encrypted. So those are some of the most basic things. There's more advanced things that you might want to consult with an IT professional to take care of. You know, we still have internet routers out there that have the default password and username, admin. And that's a very easy way to get into your network, is just by coming in and basically taking control of your router. But again, that's something that you might probably want to work with an IT professional to get done. But you got to have a security officer, and you've got to do a risk assessment. Identify where your risks are. If you have a practice of throwing away charts in the dumpster behind your building, you might want to look into that. That's a big no-no, and OCR hates that. So things like that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, every example that you just listed, I'm sure has come out of a headline probably within the past week or two. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that these are uncommon events, as you're suggesting.
Right.
And I don't think you're suggesting that.
Right. You
know, believe it or not, as we're already kind of wrapping up towards the end of our time, I'd like to kind of close with one final question, which is to hopefully leave you on a, you know, with some hope. But, you know, kind of what is the most positive sign or hopeful sign with regard to security that you're seeing?
Well, I tell you, I mentioned before that more and more I'm getting involved in sales where the prospect, the future customer, comes and says, hey, look, I really want to talk to your security officer. Hey, can you give me this documentation? And more as these customers come and talk with us, they're aware of HITRUST. They're aware of SOC 2 reports. They're aware of other sort of documentation and things that need to be happening. They ask us really intelligent questions. So from my perspective, you know, working for a vendor, it really seems like more and more practices, even the smaller ones, have a greater awareness of security and understanding why it's so important. And we get really good questions. You know, back in the day, you know, again, I've been here for a couple of years, and, you know, 15 years ago, you know, first of all, the sort of common judgment was that, you know, storing patient records in the cloud wasn't secure. And then we slowly got past that, where people started understanding, hey, yeah, it's actually a pretty good idea. But the assumption was, well, hey, if you're in the cloud, you must be secure. And there, you know, no questions came out at all. But now we're getting some really good questions. So I think there's definitely a lot of awareness out there.
Well, I think a lot of signs of hope to leave on. And as I said, believe it or not, we are already out of time. I want to thank my guest, Troy Young, for a great conversation today.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.